Welcome to the second and final session here of the Physical Sciences Symposium. I'm Randy Isaac. I'm happy to moderate this session. And I'm particularly pleased to introduce to you our first speaker here, Dillard Ferris, who got his PhD in physics from Berkeley. And from there, he went to Wheaton College, where as a freshman, I had the privilege of having him as my first physics professor, and I was his first student, basically. So we trained him, right?
First year? You was your freshman year?
Yes. Well, no, I guess my sophomore year when he came. Any rate, developed great admiration. I learned a lot from him in many, many ways, and I've kept in touch. And he's done some great work here with ASA, and I'm very pleased to have him talk here about how the iron grip of plasma.
No, wait, what is that?
Title, that's not your title. You go give your title.
Okay. When I was preparing this, I actually had forgotten what the title said in my abstract, and so this is what I call my wishful title: How the Iron Grip of Classical Causality and the Icy Grip of Thermodynamic Heat Death Yielded to the Amazing Grace of Quantum Physics, Product Placement, my book, which just came out last year, and the Open Hand of Teleology. This is not only too long a title, but it's way past my pay scale. As a physicist, I probably should never even use the word teleology. Maybe I won't use it anymore for the day, but definitely it is something that I should be leaving to the theologians and philosophers. And we, as physicists, we often have people say, "Oh, I could never do physics." And I coming to a conference like this and hearing talks where people can talk about all of these wonderful theological and philosophical topics makes me say I could never do that, and I shouldn't be trying to do most of that sort of thing. The basic problem that we're facing, from my point of view here in this, is that modern science basis was, and this is going back to classical physics, was that we have determination by a causal chain from the past. And if we have anything that includes something as large as life and faith, we need to have something which includes our aim, our telos, meaning and purpose. A lot of other words like promise and covenant and eschatology would perhaps fit better with the theological point of view. The wonderful point from my perspective is that quantum mechanics has changed all this. The causal chain has been broken, at least by a statistical point of view. The discontinuity of quantum mechanics has broken that causal chain and replaced the continuity by the discontinuous jumps of quantum mechanics. The unbroken vision of that causal chain, in which determination goes from past to future, and therefore really losing meaning completely, has been replaced by what I am thinking of as a more humble, appropriate title perhaps for my talk, 2080 Hindsight and 2080 Foresight, and the ease of changing the number to 2200 and 2400 would make it perhaps more appropriate if some of you think we are going completely blind in the transition from quantum from classical physics to quantum physics. So this is the perhaps more appropriate and honest title. It is in some ways modest. But I think also that it is, in fact, huge. We cannot see the future well. Emphasis on the not there. But we can see the future, even though we can't see it well. And more importantly, if I'm right in terms of the basic quantum mechanics feature, we can, in fact, choose the future. So it is not only just seeing the future, but being able to do something to make a future. And perhaps in line with his vocabulary, this is purpose suitable. And so I'll let you decide whether it ever gets to the point of anything close to a teleological a mechanism by which God can choose, which I call grace. We can choose, which I call choice, free will. Nature can choose, where we don't really know what nature is doing, and we call it chance. And we can do this all without breaking natural law, without going against the ideas of lawful order. This is a huge, huge thing with a very limited ability on our part, so I'm using these few slides to indicate what I consider this, the scale of where the problems are and where I am in this whole thing. Glacial Goliath, and see this little point down here? That's that. And that's not really me, but that's like me with my great instrument, which I guess we call those ice picks, right? So my purpose today is to just give you one little tool which will give us some of the ideas of quantum physics and what quantum physics can do in relationship to this idea of seeing backward and seeing forward. The tool that I want to use is a very modest tool, which I don't see it on the top of anybody's head, but it's so common that there it is, at least lying on the table for some of us, polarizing filters. And I think even the cheapest sunglasses now are polarizing filters. And it's everywhere. Much more prevalent than we normally think, the idea of polarization and the use of polarized light. For example, I pulled out my sunglasses and looked at my TV, and there's the picture of it, but there's my TV with the glasses turned by 90 degrees. My TV is polarized like that. My computer, 45 degrees clockwise for my sunglasses, 45 degrees the other direction. Here is a photography with and without a polarizing filter. This is the reflections off of water. So that it obscures almost everything. You can't see through those reflections when you put the polarizing filter on there. Cuts one of the polarizations completely, and you get a really clear. And you have to even look fairly hard to see that that's the same, that same picture, same place. This was studied experimentally by one of Napoleon's soldiers in 1808, and he is most famous for this law of polarization, which he found. Here is the simple idea of this, that you have one polarizer which polarizes it. The first one is on the back. The second one, if it's aligned with it, lets all the light through. If it's perpendicular to it, it cuts the light completely. If it is at an angle, it has this relationship with the angle. The cosine squared theta. And here is the beautiful cosine squared and sine squared graphs. If any of you would like to play with these, I know you probably all had plenty of polarizers, but here are two of them that you can turn with respect to each other to see them basically mechanically switch the light on or off.
Try them against your watch.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I was thinking calculators sometimes will have it. I don't know. My watch doesn't, but smartphones may or may not, depending on where they are. This law was understood, quote, by the end of the 19th century completely as an idea of looking at different components of electric field in the electromagnetic radiation with Maxwell's equations. But also this taps in with this cosine and sine into a long tradition of couple millennia Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. When you divide by c squared, you get, and that's not the velocity of light, you get sine squared plus cosine squared equal 1. And this Pythagorean tradition is really a deep root of our theoretical physics, where we see the beauty and the power of the mathematics just almost feeling like it produces the physical effect. It's one of the things of Wigner's, what does he call it? Unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. And so that tradition is very strong.
What? It doesn't go.
What? It stopped on me. Can't go to the next slide. What did I hit?
Oh, don't let Randy help you.
Yeah, right. That's going to crash entirely. You like going here? Interesting. Let's get out of presenter mode. You probably don't need that. Something's wrong.
Does this game work?
Just dead, huh?
Something hung up right in the middle, huh? System crashed. Jeez, what's that all about? That's not good. Yeah.
You know, there's a tradition in physics going back to Pauli that he ruined everything with equipment, and so there's a tradition that if good theoretical physicists will always ruin the equipment. So somebody may have to be thrown overboard here.
Yeah, probably me. I'll get out of here. This thing is frozen tight.
Do you run equipment, Don?
I'm a theoretical physicist, so if I'm in the room.
You didn't run it?
Yeah, right, yeah.
You may have to at least move back further in the room.
Yeah. Sheepers. I don't know. Frozen dead.
Yeah, there are accounts of that.
I don't know. This baby's stuck. Okay, I don't know what to tell you. We got to reboot the whole thing.
Okay, let's reboot.
You know, but can you? Let's try.
Turn it off.
We turn it off. We got to reboot this thing. Come on. I don't know. You can keep talking if you want.
I've got my thing so tightly tied to slides, right. that I probably should not keep talking.
Yeah, it's going to reboot here a little bit, but it's a slow reboot. Probably doesn't have an SSD in it. We'll give you a few extra minutes here.
Yeah, I can. Whoops.
Okay.
I don't know whether you can see it here with my switch. Turned it off, turned it back on. Like that.
That's the slowest reboot I've seen. All right, here we go. Now, which one was yours? Right here, right?
That's...
Diller, do you know how the
Frenchman, I forgot his name.
Malice is the way we say it, at least the way I say it, but I think it's supposed to be something more modern.
At that point in the history of technology, how did he make a polarizing
moment? How did he make...
What did he have as
a polarizer? I don't know. Certainly the ones that I'm handing around are 20th century plastic.
And they stripped, right? They stretched the plastic and that... And then aligns the molecules or something.
Did they use minerals, crystals?
I'm sure there were some crystal things.
Oh, sure, natural, yeah.
Calcite crystal, because you know you can take calcite crystals and you put it on something, you can see the two different polarizations.
The double reflection.
You could actually separate them.
Yeah.
So some kind of crystals, but I really don't know what he did.
That's
I think you're somewhere around there.
That's all right. Where I was.
Try that. Let's
okay,
do that.
Let's see if we can keep going here. And as I said, this goes back to Pythagoras. Okay, and so we had this beautiful form of the experimental rules. Tied into the theoretical ideas very well. And then Einstein, who actually was obviously great in this theoretical realm and seeing the mathematics, but he came along and ruined it by saying that light doesn't come in vectors which are continuous in their amplitude, but it comes in individual pieces. And when he said this in 1905, he couldn't get anybody to really believe it. In fact, Planck recommended him for a position at Berlin University and in the German Academy of Science, but stated explicitly that he really had messed it up on this point. But after all, you can't be a good physicist without making some risky moves, and so he nobody believed it. And as I've written there, you. In 1925, it was named the photons. And I can't remember the title of it, but it's a very ironic title by a chemist, Lewis. I can't think of his first name, that named it. And this is what happens to the cosine squared function. When you start getting individual pieces coming in, this is a simulation where you're looking at only 100 photons at each of 100 places. And as you get smaller and smaller numbers of photons, the statistics make it look worse and worse and worse when we're down to one photon in each of 100 slots at different angles there. There are only three places on this graph where the answer is known correctly. In the probability theory, one is the first point here, which is got probability one, or one of the polarizations, one right in the middle somewhere there, where it's got zero chance of being up at the top, and then back up there, I think I got back to the probability one. All of the rest of those are just points which have some probability of being up or down, but they can't be in the middle like we see the nice formula for the cosine squared and the sine squared. Okay, Einstein was right, the rest of the world was wrong. And this then is sets us up for the very basic quantum mechanical sequence. We do a measurement or a preparation. We force the system to say yes or no, this one or that one. And then we leave it alone, and we don't know what's going on. If we don't make a measurement, we don't know what it is, we don't see it, and according to Wittgenstein, we shouldn't be talking about it. And then we can go and make another measurement and see what we get. And as we know in quantum mechanics, we know a probability for it, but we don't know at all. We can't make any predictions specifically about it. Now, Einstein had opinions about this, too. He said, you don't get rid of reality here. It's still got an answer. which is going to come out over there. And we would call that some kind of a reality, a specification. It's got the answer somehow encoded in it, inscribed in it, some formula for it, or somebody flipped a coin, or whatever it is, but it's got an answer there that's going to come out on the other side. So, Einstein's reality version, which is, I consider him the last classical physicist, because that's a really classical physics idea. It may be unknown only by God, and God may have done it by probabilistic means. He may be flipping coins, roulette wheels, or whatever, but it's scripted. It's there. And we get an answer, which we just read off from nature. Fortunately, those people who didn't believe in the photon still developed quantum mechanics, and Bohr was at the head of that kind of thing. And he has a different view of what's going on. I call it limbo. I don't know, that may be a little too Catholic for some of us, but I think that is really a Catholic word. Something like a purgatory. And what he says is that it's a bunch of possible worlds. It's not any one of them particular. It's maybe a combination of them in some sense, but it awaits the specification over here. You don't have an answer until you ask it the question, and you don't know what question is going to be asked. And so it's a really different, so the measurement is really in some sense creating it. So there's a creation. And so that can be thought of purely as a interpretational question, because it is in that realm where we haven't made a measurement here. We're in the present, and it depends on what measurement we make. So, Einstein reality, nature is reality waiting to be viewed. Bohr reality is nature is potentially unfolding under an action of choices. Its choice, internally in some sense, our choice. We are, of course, part of nature, and so that wouldn't really be quite different. Or God's choice, he is still involved in nature, whether however he does it. And, of course, he would not have said the word God in that. But shortly after Bohr died, within 2 years, John Bell discovered a theorem, which is probably the most important theorem. Actually, we don't do theorems much in physics, but the most important theorem of 20th century physics, I think perhaps it is, although I've heard other people give some other candidates. According to this theorem, local reality, which involves the causality as well as this actualization, local reality, where the values are scripted, even if statistically, will give a certain relationship between the values of the theta I and the theta F, the initial and the final. And this is perhaps a little bit too busy, but this is the cosine squared function, that nice smooth line up there. And this dark line, which I've done there, is what Bell's theorem says is the limit. That is, any local reality which you can concoct in any way will produce effects down below that line there. Quantum mechanics, Bohr's interpretation of it, the idea that the measurement does something to it, is that one up there. So you see there's a gap between what local reality ideas will produce down here and what quantum mechanics, in fact, does produce up there. And within 20 or so years after that, experiments were done well enough that we can tell the difference. Whoa. Oh, my goodness.
And I gave you credit.
Really? Okay. And so, Einstein was wrong. Bohr was right, the cosine squared is right, and the local reality is wrong. Okay. So this is our sequence of these things, and I put it, this is basically a repeat of that last one. Okay. So quantum mechanics really basically says choice is available, we can make a choice of measurement, choice is required, and choice makes a difference. Now, I want to look at this back sight, looking back. If we're sitting in the middle, we don't know how it was prepared, how do we do it? Well, we can take an exit poll. It's just exactly like we do in political polling. And this is the kind of work, and you won't want to look at all the details of this, but basically it's a binomial distribution which looks more and more like a Gaussian, and the more data we take, the narrower we can make it, and we get that this is how well we can do it, 1 over the square root of n, to produce an accuracy in our angle estimate. This is in case we're, I'll just pass this over, and this you can just see is something in terms of information theory, you gain bits. The main idea being that you have to get 4 times as much data in order to get 1 bit of information. So it's really expensive, and that's why polls are not terribly good sometimes. Okay, and this I will also skip over because it is another way of looking at this that quantum mechanics and information theory are basically kind of the same thing. Now think in terms of looking forward. How can we produce what we want to in the future? And the idea is that we can ask leading questions. We get to choose what we ask. And there are 2 things that we got going for us. Cosine squared plus sine squared is 1. It's going to go in one or the other. And 90 degrees, it's either going to get this one or that one. A photon comes in, it's 1 or the other. And secondly, each small miss that we have in terms of our direction gives us a very small error rate proportional to the change in theta squared. So it's like this. We want to get a theta sub f. We put our 2 directions at 45 degrees with respect to it, and we're going to get one or the other. And then we gradually ask the questions closer and closer to where we want. We break it down into n steps, and each step has a miss by that's proportional to 1 over n, but each of those steps then has an error of only 1 over n squared. We have n steps, each of them getting an 1 over n squared, and we get a miss rate which is only proportional to 1 over n. So by large numbers of questions, leading questions, going closer and closer, we can get essentially any amount of accuracy that we want in getting the answer that we want. Here's a kind of a picture of it. If you put a whole bunch of these together that are perfect, then they will get approach 100% certainty in your answer. And it's kind of like a Pac-Man thing. Okay, you get it. Okay. So that's the idea of getting the answer, any answer that you want. The capability of aiming for the future. Okay, and I'll skip over these 2 and just conclude with this. We are not prisoners of our past. Here is our past, going back to the Garden of Eden, a famous painting of the angel keeping them out of the garden. Here is our present. I apologize for the sexist pictures here, but if any of you women would like to be in the pig pen with us guys, you may join us. Why look for the rich among the poor? I don't see them anymore. Would the son be doing the slave's work? He is not here. We sent him home. Whoops, I skipped one somehow back there. Our future, the return of the prodigal son. We are not driven from or by our past. We follow and aim for our future. Our credits. For more context, you could look at my book. For Bell's Theorem, you can get it from the horse's mouth here, or I wrote an article in the Perspectives Journal a couple of years ago, so you can get it from Balaam's ass. These are standard optical things from a long ago. And you can read, that's another one that I missed, okay.
How can we verify that?
say to your speaker phone, play Dillard's theme music, and it'll play it.
Alexa, come on.
Okay.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, how about two very quick questions? Bob.
Just a quick comment. You know, one of the things, I mean, this is all well and good, makes a lot of sense to me, but what used to exasperate me from my early days as a scientist are phrases like this. We have modern physics. Modern physics says you can't know anything. We have the theory of relativity. That means we have no absolutes. And that's the kind of stuff that you have to confront in the public at large. And so the quick comment I want to make is that underlying all of this is that this is not unconstrained. You have the mathematics underlying it that then governs the questions and the answers and how you get there. And so, you know, somehow we need to convey that. That's, you know, from the talks to the public at large.
Okay. One more.
Okay. Classical determinism did not give us free will, free choice. Randomness is not free choice, as I understand it. Do you see free choice and physics speaking of
Obviously, there's a big step from saying randomness or quantum mechanics to going to what goes on inside us, right? And all I'm saying here is that there is a mechanism, and in that mechanism, there is possibility for choice to make a difference. And whether that does anything for teleology or other of the big terms, I'll have to leave to the philosophers and theologians.
Can I comment on that?
Yeah.
Usually, in thinking about these problems, there are three categories. There's randomness, determinism, and then there's something that is known as openness, which means that the end is not built from the beginning. Randomness would be, there's lots of coins, you flip them all, there's a definite state, but there are too many of them for you to actually predict, whereas openness means it's actually undetermined beforehand. And that could be an analogy.
Yeah,
it's not going to cause free will in the neurons.
And right, and another way of expressing it is that it's statistical causality. And so there's room for causality, and there's room for something from the outside or from something internal in within the thing. I mean, some people will even dare to use the word free will for electrons. It's pretty daring.
Okay, just thank the speaker again.
Okay, thank you very much. And now it's my privilege to...